This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 29 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me tonight, as he always is Mike Morrison. In this episode, we'll be discussing the ethics of punishment in Star Trek. Mike, welcome to the show. It's been a couple of weeks since you and I have had a chance to sit down and record together.
It's been a couple of weeks, and as we've always said, this is the fun thing that we get to do every week, so I'm really excited to be back on mic with you and doing Metatrex. I think this is going to be a fun topic, even though it doesn't seem like punishment would be a fun topic. I guess it all depends on how old you are. If you're 12, 13 years old, punishment's probably not a fun topic. When you're 45 like I am, it's going to be a fun topic.
Right, you're saying it won't be punishment to talk about punishment in Star Trek?
It will be zero punishment to talk about punishment.
It does sound a bit like you've got a bit Machiavellian as you've gotten older, though. Now that you're a parent, a little older, a little wiser, are you saying you enjoy punishing, but you didn't like being punished when you were younger? Is that what I heard you say?
Well, there were times when I enjoyed punishment when I was younger, but...
Oh, dear.
Well, so sometimes, Zachary, you mean to tell me you never went out and did something just to get in trouble?
No, actually, I don't think I ever have, actually. Maybe not with the intention of getting in trouble.
I can say without a shadow of a doubt, I have.
Sounds like a story for another time.
That is a story for another time.
Well, like I said, it's been a couple of weeks since you and I have had a chance to sit down and record, and we always hate to do that. You know, we try to keep Metatrex coming every week if possible, but sometimes life just gets in the way. It's been a busy couple of weeks for me, busy couple of weeks for you, and we say this often that Metatrex is kind of the highlight of our week sometimes. So, we do apologize for having to take 2 weeks to get a new episode out to everyone, but here we are tonight, ready to talk about punishment. But Mike, before we get started talking about punishment, if I remember correctly, we have a new iTunes review that we'd like to share with listeners out there.
We do. And let me just say to our listeners, don't let Zachary fool you. The truth of the matter is we had Binars doing some upgrades to our systems here on the Starship Theseus. And well, we had to take it out of commission because it kind of got stolen. No, you're absolutely right. Life does occasionally get in the way. And I know we don't need to remind our listeners that we have lives, jobs, families, and, you know, sometimes those things have to take precedence. We hate to delay an episode, but, you know, occasionally it happens. But I'm glad that we were able to work out things and get our schedules lined up to be able to put this episode 29 together, talk about punishment. And you're absolutely right. We do have a new iTunes review. This review comes to the United States iTunes store. It is from KC Trekkie FM. And KC Trekkie FM says, Metatrex amazes, and gives us 5 stars, Zachary. He says, or he or she says, Metatrex with Zachary and Mike is a fascinating show. I had a range of experiences while listening to Metatrex, ranging from feeling immersed in the Trek universe, feeling as if I'm chatting with friends, and feeling like I'm back in my political philosophy classes at Kansas State University. The guys bring a nice balance to the show with their backgrounds and beliefs and do a wonderful job framing the topics and discussing the underlying philosophy and history of each topic. A show that links Kant, Nietzsche, John Stuart Mill, and Star Trek is a dream come true for me, my favorite Trek FM show. KC Trekkie FM, we just want to say thank you so much for that 5-star rating and your review on the United States store. And we just want to remind our listeners that we would love to engage you. Feel free to visit iTunes, whether it's in the United States store or one of the international stores. Leave us a rating and review. We might share it here on the podcast.
Yeah, there's really no way to convey how much reviews like that really warm our hearts. When I first started conceiving of MetaTrex quite a few months ago now, I was really not sure whether anyone would really want to tune in and listen to us talk about Star Trek and philosophy. And it's really great to know that there are listeners out there who really enjoy what we're trying to do and the connections we're trying to make and the discussions we like to have about Star Trek and philosophy and some of these deeper issues in Star Trek. And I'm just really pleased that it's having that kind of effect on listeners. So thank you very much for that wonderful review. That really does warm our hearts.
As Zachary and I often say, this is a labor of love for us. And, you know, we so enjoy putting the show together, and we put our own personal passions into every single show. And to get that kind of feedback from our listeners, it really does warm our hearts. And it honestly gives us the vigor and drive we need to push forward. And we really appreciate that. We appreciate all the ratings and reviews that we receive and the interactions that we get from our listeners in the Babel Conference as well.
Well, Mike, there's one more quick item of business I want to get out of the way before we dive in to talk about our actual topic. We want to announce a very important and significant milestone in the history of Trek.fm. It's been over 5 years since Trek FM was started with The Ready Room, Trek FM's first podcast. And that show, The Ready Room, on which you're a regular guest and I'm a regular guest, that show, which is actually Trek FM's sort of grandfather / flagship show on the network, has just recently had its 200th episode. And that's an incredible milestone. You know, here we're doing MetaTrex 29 tonight. But The Ready Room has been going for 200 episodes now in over 5 years. And at that time, The Ready Room was just its own podcast. It took some time for Trek FM to grow into the network that it is now with 20-something shows and, you know, about 35 hosts who collectively form the family that is Trek FM, and the amazing volume of content that we can bring to listeners every day, 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 episodes in a day sometimes. And, it's just a massive amount of growth. So we really want to thank all the Trek FM listeners, MetaTrex listeners, listeners of other podcasts on the Trek FM network. There's no end in sight. We're going to keep trying to bring as much great content as we can coming to you. But just want to pause and say congratulations to Chris and congratulations to everyone on Trek FM. It's a labor of love for all of us. You know, Trek FM is a listener-supported network, and we could not do this without the support and the cheerleading and the well wishes and the contributions of listeners out there, financial or moral or otherwise. And so, again, it's just an incredible milestone. When you look back and think 5 years and that many podcasts, you know, 200 podcasts is an incredible time commitment. So congratulations to Chris and congratulations to The Ready Room.
I echo those remarks. Absolutely. I too want to congratulate Chris. You know, I don't think listeners realize the time and commitment, and you talk about passion and zeal that he's put into this network and into The Ready Room, Trek FM's flagship show. It really is a labor of love for him, and the time and effort and energy that he puts into it, while like the rest of us juggling, you know, a job, family, and so on. And I should say, as most of our listeners I think probably know, you know, he coordinates this really global network from Tokyo, Japan. And how he does it sometimes I just don't know, but he does, and he's managed to put 200 fantastic episodes of The Ready Room together. And he has grown this network from just a single show to the network that it is today, spanning not just all the live action, we used to say, not just the live action shows, but also the animated series. And, you know, we jump in and talk about the movies and the books. And it's just, it really is covering every corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. And Chris, congratulations. What a milestone. I just want to say personally, thank you so much for giving Zachary and I the opportunity to be a part of the network. And when we were kind of hatching Metatrex and kind of in our infancy, taking those first steps. You were such an encouragement and such a help. You've taught us so much, and we just want to say thank you, and we appreciate it, and congratulations. Well, with that, Zachary, do you want to dive in? Let's talk about punishment.
Punishment
in Star Trek. The ethics of punishment in Star Trek.
Well, punishment in Star Trek is a really interesting topic to me because I think the popular discussion on punishment is a little simplistic. It tends to focus on some very specific issues like capital punishment and whatnot. And punishment in Star Trek is interesting because Star Trek is supposed to represent the best of humanity in the future. So in theory, you should be able to look at Star Trek for an enlightened view of what crime and punishment mean for humanity. And of course, by extension, the rest of the sentient species in Star Trek. And, you know, we can do this comparative analysis of different species approach to punishment. We can look at the Federation and see how that speaks to maybe our ideals as a species. I'm looking forward to seeing what we can discover about the nature of punishment by looking at some examples from Star Trek tonight.
Well, it's fascinating to me, Zachary, because sometimes we as fans, and certainly Star Trek, I think to some degree, portrays themselves in such a way that the society of the Star Trek universe has evolved in such a way that one would think that there would be no need for punishment. We all strive in the future, according to the Star Trek universe, for the greater good, and all of us are working together. We've evolved past, you know, things like violence and malice, and we have no need of money, so there's no greed, there's no hunger, and so on and so forth. And this idealized picture of the universe, seems to be littered with examples of crime and punishment in it. So I think this is going to be a fascinating conversation.
Well, from the little we've seen of Federation penal colonies inside Star Trek, it sure looks like it's hard to tell the difference between a Federation penal colony and being on Ryza. It looks like it's that luxurious of a prison experience.
Well, in the very first episode of Voyager, Caretaker, we get to see the penal colony in New Zealand, and it does look kind of like a vacation destination.
It's a walk in the park.
At least it does to me. Right. It's a walk in the park. You know, there's no blood, there's no sweat, there's no tears. It's green grass, it's beautiful lush gardens and trees and sunshine and blue skies. And that's a far cry from Rua Pente, if you ask me.
Yeah, no dilithium mining for good old Tom Paris.
No dilithium mining for Tom Paris. In fact, there were times in Voyager, and I'm actually doing a Voyager rewatch right now. There are a few instances in which Tom says that he would trade the difficulties and trials and tribulations of the Delta Quadrant to go back to that penal colony in New Zealand.
If you know, I'm picturing Captain Picard if he were in a Federation prison, kind of lounging around on a kind of like being on Ryza, lounging around reading a little Shakespeare.
He's got his swim trunks on, his shirt's open. He's, you know, he's enjoying himself.
But it's funny you say that because as you were talking, it kind of occurs to me that I think when we look at the relationship between humans and various alien races in Star Trek, oftentimes the humans represent kind of the idealized version of ourselves. And then what we see in the various alien races are what humans are actually like, the kinds of things that end up getting... you know, whenever Star Trek gets sort of moralizing on a particular issue, you know, look at what the Klingons are doing, look at the bad things the Romulans are doing, and then the Federation, you know, Starfleet characters come along and sort of enlighten them about a better way to do things. Usually that better way is an idealized version of ourselves, and that, you know, the various things that the alien races are doing are that really look like bad things from the perspective of Starfleet or the Federation are what humans in the real world actually do. So I think we can learn a lot about the nature of punishment here in the real world by looking at different kinds of punishment that we see in Star Trek, not necessarily in the Federation, but from various alien races. And I think we can learn a bit about our ideals from looking at the sort of idealized forms of punishment, this more enlightened approach to punishment that we might see in the Federation.
Yeah, the and all kidding aside, the Federation's take on punishment really, even by today's standards, are seemingly lax We joke and kid about the penal colony there in New Zealand, but it did rather look like a vacation destination. And anytime we see examples of Federation justice, it seems very enlightened, if you will. And in comparison to other species, other races in the Star Trek universe, very lax indeed.
Well, except for the contrast between what you see with Tom Paris and the Federation penal colony in Caretaker, the beginning of Voyager, with that episode, might have to help me with the title, but the episode where Tom Paris has been sentenced to 30 days in the brig and Janeway is essentially feeding him on bread and water.
Yeah, that's actually called 30 Days, I believe.
30 Days, exactly. And,
yes,
you know, it's the closest you get to, isolated, solitary confinement in Star Trek.
Yes, yes. He was probably, during that 30-day period, as he's writing the letter to his father that he was writing in that episode, he probably was pining for the days of the New Zealand penal colony. Nobody messes with Janeway on her ship.
Yeah, Janeway was hell bent to teach Tom Paris a lesson there, and it's funny because that speaks to the different, the different purposes that punishment serves in society, and I think it's just not clear at all what role punishment is supposed to serve. On the one hand, punishment can be a deterrent. You know, if you are afraid of getting punished for something, you might not commit a crime. A lot of times people think that people deserve a punishment. There's a kind of quid pro quo, what for what, an eye for an eye kind of dessert. If you commit something bad should be done to you, and you deserve it mm-hmm. in some sort of sense that would need to be fleshed out. And another possible view is that punishment maximizes overall good for society, what you'd call social utility. It prevents harm and promotes the greater good in some sort of public welfare sense. Some people think you can sort of pay back a debt to society. It's like being a redeemed or paying back a debt. You know, if you've, stolen, then you put your time in, you've somehow redeemed yourself. And there, these mm-hmm. nuances to punishment, I think, are really subtle and complicated, and they overlap. They're not all mutually exclusive either. So when we say punishment, I think that's a great question. What role does punishment serve? Like, for example, that issue of Tom Paris being punished inside the brig for 30 days, I think arguably that was punishment as education. Janeway was just trying to teach him a lesson. She hoped that he would learn his lesson and learn to be a better Starfleet officer, and maybe a better person and a better adult at the end of that experience. It wasn't necessarily to deter him from doing anything in the future. It wasn't necessarily for the greater good. I think in that case, it was purely to teach him a lesson.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're correct. And I think arguably it worked because...
You're saying we get a more mature Tom Paris at the end of that episode?
We got a more mature Tom Paris at the end of that episode. You know, when you talk about...
Yes.
So, Zachary, it occurs to me when you're talking about crime and punishment, in order to first ascertain if the punishment that you're choosing is appropriate for said crime... You have to answer a couple of questions, and one of those questions would be, was the crime committed willfully? I think you're probably delving into the debate of free will versus determinism. We talked about that a great deal in our first two Metatrex episodes, Metatrex 1 and 2. If our listeners who have joined us since then want to go back and listen to those episodes, I don't think there's a need for us to rehash the debate here. But, that question of, was it something that the person was willfully in control of, or was it something that was outside their control? And then from there, you go on to what is the appropriate punishment for that. But that seems to me like the first question that you have to answer before really coming to a determination as to appropriate punishment.
Yeah, I think here in the real world, outside the Star Trek universe, there's a lot of distinctions to make. I think first of all, there's the distinction between some types of crimes or offenses or what you would call strict liability. It doesn't matter what your mental state is. Doesn't matter what your intention is. Something like a speeding ticket is a good example of that. If you speed, it doesn't mm-hmm. matter what your intention was. The mere fact that you did the action is enough to justify the punishment, getting a fine, right? As opposed opposed to other kinds of crimes that do have this intentional component, you know, whether it's theft or whether it's murder or pick your favorite crime, you know, oftentimes there's gradations of the crime made with different levels of punishment based on different kinds of mental states. You know, you could do the very same action. You know, murder is like the typical example. If you kill someone else, if you do that intentionally, then that's first degree murder. If you do that, you know, not intentionally, but with negligence, that can be a different category of murder and so on. And we make these gradations of different degrees of punishment. And it always seems a little arbitrary, right? You know, you sort of start with the maximum offense and kind of work your way backwards and kind of flesh out some reasonable gradations that make sense. But it always does strike me as a little bit arbitrary. But is there some parallel like that inside the Star Trek universe? I mean, do you ever see an example of like strict liability where it doesn't matter what you've done, if you know what your intention or mental state was, if you did an action, you're getting punished no matter what? I think a lot of times Starfleet would have to be like this a little bit. If you violate certain rules, you're going to be punished in some way, and it doesn't matter whether you meant to. It doesn't matter. Maybe violating the Prime Directive might be an example of something like that. If you violate the Prime Directive, it doesn't matter what your intention was. You broke the rule. And there might be some consequences associated with that. But I'm not sure whether we really get a great peek into the really granular, you know, gradations of types of punishment and types of crimes and how that calculation kind of actually works inside the Star Trek universe. I don't think we ever get a really great peek at that.
We really don't. We don't get a good peek at the justice system inside the Federation at all, really. We know, for instance, in the original series, in the episode Menagerie, you know, there was General Order 7, which forbid Starfleet vessels from going to Talos IV. And we know, Zachary, that that carried the punishment of death. And we also know that got set aside in that particular instance after the Federation was able to view the evidence that the Talosians presented for their reasoning as to why Spock was compelled to take Christopher Pike to Talos IV to seemingly retire. We also see Julian Bashir's father in Deep Space Nine. He violated Federation law by allowing his son to receive genetic enhancements. And we saw him engaged in a plea deal with Federation Judge Advocate General. But we didn't really see how the mechanics of the justice system work. We only see, you know, that there was a crime and there was a punishment. And at least in both of those cases, the said punishment was kind of set aside because the determination was, in the end, to some degree, it served the greater good.
Mike, I'm so glad you thought to mention the Menagerie from the original series because, you know, even though I did grow up watching the original series when I was really young, when it was in syndication, I basically grew up on The Next Generation and then was a fan of Voyager and Deep Space Nine into the 90s. And it's funny because there's really a difference. I mean, I think you get that really fleshed out, enlightened view of humanity in general and kind of by extension punishment in particular in later iterations of Star Trek, The Next Generation and Deep Space Nine and Voyager and Enterprise. But when you look at the original series, you know, this actually strikes me as a really strange case. I mean, what you described, the situation with the Menagerie, a death penalty for violating this rule and going to this planet, Talos IV. Not only is it a capital punishment offense, which we don't see in Star Trek very much. If anything, later iterations of Star Trek tended to avoid capital punishment and moralize kind of against it. Say, you know, an enlightened species wouldn't do this. But it's also strict liability. If you violate the rule, you know, you get the death penalty. You know, and yeah, there's a hearing involved, but there's a huge leap from going to this planet to, you know, to death penalty. And it doesn't strike me as the most enlightened. You know, there must be some, of course, there's something really interesting and extreme and unusual about this particular planet, but it does strike me as way out of proportion and not necessarily in line with at least Gene Roddenberry's later, more fleshed out vision about what an enlightened species would do in terms of punishment.
Yeah, Zachary, I'm picturing in my mind, at least in my head canon, you know, an argument that takes place between Captain Kirk and, say, any random Commodore. You know, why? You know, I can just see William Shatner doing this. Why? Why, Commodore? Why can't we go to Talos IV? I don't understand. And the Commodore just simply says, "Because I said so, Captain." it's the classic "because I said so," because we really don't know what the circumstances are that led to this particular law being put in place that carried such a heavy penalty. We've talked about it a little bit on Metatrex in the past. You know, that you can certainly say, well, you know, the Talosians' mental capabilities, but obviously those mental capabilities were able to reach all the way to Earth, to the to the heart of the Federation. So that doesn't seem plausible to me. So what is it about this particular planet that the Federation declares, you know, the death penalty for any ship that, you know, goes anywhere near the system? I don't know. I don't have the answer to that question, but I find it fascinating that, you know, in the end, it's simply because the Federation said so.
Yeah, it seems to just kind of violate the intuition about the nature of punishment. I think for most of us, we have this intuition that the punishment should fit the crime in some way, right? A more extreme crime justifies a more extreme punishment. And again, you know, how many years in prison that means in contemporary society, you know, that's fairly arbitrary. But, you know, at least you can say there's a qualitative distinction between, say, murder and theft and then something, a lower offense like, you know, like speeding or something, or jaywalking, right? These are genuine qualitative differences in terms of the severity of a crime. And we tend to have punishments that fit accordingly. So, you know, so the running assumption, again, I don't want to focus capital punishment, the death penalty too much, because there's so many other things to talk about with in terms of punishment. But in terms of capital punishment, we tend to think, you know, that is kind of reserved for the most extreme crimes. You know, these mid-grade crimes like theft or espionage or whatever don't get the death penalty. I think that's a running assumption in this day and age. So in the 23rd century, to have the death penalty being applied to what looks like a fairly minor infraction, visiting this planet that's been forbidden, there's some leap of reasoning there that I've just never quite understood about that episode.
Absolutely. Yeah, I do think that we should probably highlight some other forms of punishment, and we shouldn't dwell on this, but I think you're absolutely right. And I think as we move along, we again see very few examples of the death penalty, at least in the Federation. We see it to some degree in other cultures within the Alpha, and for that matter, the Gamma Quadrant. But this seems rather unique for the Federation. Zachary, you mentioned other forms of punishment. I just want to kind of bullet point a few forms of punishment that we see through the iterations of the Star Trek universe. You've already mentioned Briggs, that I think we get to see on just about each and every starship that we have a series about. We also can equate the holding chamber, the holding cell on Deep Space Nine, in Constable Odo's security department as a brig. There are internment camps, labor camps. We see those a few times. Penal colonies, we've already mentioned with our example of caretaker. We see prison ships. We see reorientation centers. We see at least we get a mention of a cryostatic prison. We have
Star Trek Demolition Man.
Star Trek Demolition Man.
With a cryo chamber, right? Okay. So if Tom Paris comes out of the brig knitting, this intense desire, yes, to knit a sweater, you know, we'll know what happened.
His brain is gone.
Tom Paris, Demolition Man.
Tom Paris, Demolition Man. The Dominion, I'm going to move along. The Dominion used a bioweapon in order to exact punishment on a society for resistance. And then you've got Punishment Protocol 9 Alpha. Zachary, do you remember Punishment Protocol 9 Alpha?
I think you threw me for a loop there, Mike. What is that? I can't remember that reference.
Punishment Protocol 9 states that you have to go stand in a corner. Seven of Nine used that to keep the bored children in line. And of course, our good friend Icheb, shout out to Manu, refused and put a kink in protocol number 9.
I do remember that now that you mention it.
Here's to you, Icheb, for bucking protocol number 9.
You know, it's funny, you left one out that came to my mind when I was thinking about types of punishment. You remember that episode of Deep Space Nine, again, you can help me with the title, in which O'Brien lives 20 years in what's essentially solitary confinement, although he's there with a fellow prison mate. But it's all inside his mind. They're false memories. He thinks he's been punished for 20 years, but really this has only happened in a few minutes or a few hours. But he's really kind of scarred for life because this alien race that has sentenced him to 20 years in this artificially induced, purely mentally fabricated prison is, it's taken its toll on him. And I kind of wish we'd seen the long-term effects of that. Of course, like all Star Trek of the 90s, it kind of, the very next episode, O'Brien's back to normal. We don't really get to see any real long-term effects. But I like this idea that you could simulate the prison experience to the point where you don't actually have to expend the resources and actually waste people's lives, but you can get the desired effect without having to have all those negative consequences that are associated with punishment here in the real world. Like time and expense and resources and really having this long-term negative effect on people's lives, the prisoners' lives, right? Not only do you have to take into account the time in prison, but when they get out, it's incredibly difficult to get back into real society and function and get jobs and whatnot. And if you could get away with all of that, if you could just simulate the prison experience and make sure that people are going to be rehabilitated, that they're learning their lesson, that they're not going to commit crimes, that society will be safer in a few hours, why wouldn't we do that? So I actually really, really sympathize with the creators of that simulated prison experience inside that episode, however tragic it seems to have been for O'Brien's mental state.
I'm really glad you mentioned this episode because, in fact, Zachary, I had that on a whole other list. It falls under the category on my list as punishing O'Brien. Because Deep Space Nine had this way of coming up with new ways of punishing the chief. And this was certainly one of them. As you mentioned, the Agrathi Authority sentenced O'Brien to 20 cycles in a virtual prison. So what they basically did, they created an engram, and it was a virtual experience. He was in a virtual experience, and in his mind, he spent 20 years there. Near the end of his sentence, again, all of this happened in a virtual world. He ends up killing his cellmate, Ichar, and was rather haunted. I think he came away from the experience with something that I would probably equate to post-traumatic stress disorder. And in fact, his recovery was a very slow one, at least in the world of episodic television of the 1990s, a very slow recovery in which he contemplated suicide because of the experience. So I'm glad you mentioned this episode because it seems to me that, yes, you're right. And in terms of our world, we think about what is spent incarcerating criminals, if you will. And you think about, at least the idea, I think, for the most part, is that our prison system is supposed to somehow rehabilitate. And I can say from my own experience, I spent some time working as a prison chaplain. I can say that there are oftentimes folks who go into the prison system and they come out rehabilitated with a fresh perspective on the value and meaning of life. But I have to say that I think far too often we send folks to prison and they come out better criminals, if you will. And I think I think it would certainly cost a lot less money to implant a mental memory engram, creating a virtual experience, and take them out of that rather than spend millions of dollars over the course of 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years, sometimes the rest of a person's life, you know, feeding and clothing and housing and medical care and so forth and so on, only, you know, oftentimes only for them to become more hardened as criminals.
So in that particular episode, I mean, it seems pretty clear from the way the episode is written that O'Brien hasn't actually done anything wrong. So he was falsely accused from the beginning. So that, I think that colors the entire perception of the episode. But if you kind of strip that element out, you know, which way should we read that episode? Is this kind of technological form of punishment, you know, that wouldn't have been possible. It's not possible in the contemporary world, right? This is sort of future punishment. You know, what if it were possible to, you know, just affect someone's brain to the point where they think they've been punished for 20 years, but really they haven't. Is that an enlightened form of punishment, or is that an abuse to the mental state and the mental wherewithal of the victim of that kind of punishment? Like, this has taken a really negative toll on O'Brien's mental state, to the point where in the episode it sure looks like you know, O'Brien is actually the victim in this situation. He's had this negative mental consequence that he's gonna have to live with for the rest of his life. Or is the attempt to circumvent all of these negative things that we associate with the prison experience in the real world a more enlightened approach? Is that something kind of worth pursuing, or is there something inherently kind of inhumane about that approach to punishment in general?
I think if we were able to set the chief down, pour him a glass of scotch and ask him, he would probably say it was cruel and unusual punishment. And indeed, again, let's go back in universe. In terms of episodic television, he had a very slow, very dark recovery process. It was a very difficult recovery process. He contemplated suicide, as I can say that here in our own universe, oftentimes prisoners do. They go into the prison system, they come out after a period of time, they have lost their sense of hope. Oftentimes, they are unable to reintegrate Zachary in society. Oftentimes, that becomes a catalyst for them to kind of re-enter criminal activity, and what happens oftentimes is they either end up dead one way or the other, or they end up back in the prison system. So it seems to me that in an enlightened society, that is cruel and unusual. The opposite of that, I think, is also true, because in the Voyager episode Random Thoughts, they argued this a little bit, because what they were going to do, Zachary, to B'Elanna Torres was an engrammatic purge. They were going to basically lobotomize these negative thoughts that led to, or at least according to them, and she was much like O'Brien, falsely accused. But the idea was that her negative thoughts were perceived by someone in the society and caused them to commit a violent act. So the recipe, or the way to fix this, was to purge those particular thoughts from her mind, basically a lobotomy. And so they argued, B'Elanna argued, Captain Janeway argued, that Zachary was cruel and unusual. You are taking away part of somebody in order to punish them for, you know, for something that seemingly is beyond their capability to control.
Yeah, and this is where I think the discussion gets really complicated, because as I look at a case like that, okay, say in that case, B'Elanna Torres is going to have some of her memory engrams purged. And, you know, it looks to Janeway like it's cruel and unusual. I think I understand that, of course. But, you know, as you look through the different justifications for punishment in general, I think the judgment about that kind of situation could be very different based on which kind of theory of punishment you find the most plausible. I think, okay, what if that's a sort of a normal way of punishing someone in this society? Let's go down the list. Is that a good deterrent? Well, yeah, I think if I was worried about, you know, having my memory engrams purged, that might be a deterrent not to commit a crime. So it might meet that criterion. Okay, so great, put that on the checklist. That might be an effective deterrent. So if punishment is supposed to deter, put that in the plus column for that approach to punishment.
Mm-hmm.
Is that punishment deserved? You know, is that sort of an appropriate punishment for the crime? I think maybe it fails in that regard. It seems like, you know, that's a pretty extreme punishment to the point of violating a person's, maybe a prisoner's rights, maybe in the rights of anyone in general, the rights to, you know, your own body, your own mind, your own whatever. It seems like that could plausibly be an overly extreme punishment for almost any crime except for the most extreme crimes. So maybe it fails in that regard. And we can keep going down the list. I want to get your thoughts on some of these, but would that maximize social utility? Well, if it actually does, you know, prevent crime and promote happiness for the greater good, it could certainly be an effective tactic from a social utility standpoint, like any punishment. If I think the major, if you're a consequentialist, the measure is, well, does it actually succeed in making society a better place? You know, if so, then it's the right thing to do. And if not, then it's the wrong thing to do. So you'd have to ask this really practical question about whether that society has actually succeeded in maximizing its social utility or not. Is that a way for B'Elanna to kind of redeem herself if she's done something wrong in that episode? Does it meet that criterion for this redemptive sense of punishment? I think that's not clear at all. And in terms of education, well, if you're literally taking someone's memories away, it's hard to see that form of punishment could meet the criterion for re-educating someone about a better way to be or rehabilitating in that sense. So it seems to fail more often than it succeeds in terms of which theory of punishment would justify it the best. But any thoughts on any of those things, Mike? It's a fairly complicated set of factors to take into account. And I think, you know, the way you view different forms of punishment will kind of be a function of what your intuitions are about these different theories of punishment in general.
Yeah, I I'm looking at this list, you know, punishment as a deterrent. Is it deserved? Does it maximize social utility? Is it a redemption? Talking about, you know, debt to society. I think oftentimes people conflate these ideas when they are thinking about different forms of punishment. For instance, we refer to a 20-year prison sentence as paying your debt to society. But I fail to see, Zachary, at least in terms of my own philosophy, and I don't want to come across as sounding as though I'm against prison terms for crimes. That's not my position, but it in terms of my own philosophy, sitting in a, you know, 10 by 10 cell for 23 hours a day, I hardly see where there is any redemption or debt repayment in that. Oftentimes, as I said before, and I'm not saying all the time, again, I've been on the inside of the prison system as a chaplain, and I have seen people completely do a 180 degree turn and walk out of that system changed. So I don't want to discount and I don't want to diminish the good that does happen in the prison system today, but I think more often than not, 23 hours a day in a 10 by 10 cell is neither repaying a debt or providing any sense of redemption. Is it deserved? Well, I think you have to go and look at the crime. I certainly, my own philosophy is the crime or the punishment needs to fit the crime. And I think that's probably ingrained in most people. Going on, you know, I can go back to the Mosaic Law you mentioned before, an eye for an eye, that kind of, you know, that kind of philosophy is often spit out when we're talking about punishment fitting the crime. Does it deter? I think oftentimes punishment does deter criminal activity to some degree, but not always. I live in the state of Texas. I live in the Dallas area. Here in the state of Texas, we do punish violent murder with the death penalty. It's often popping up in national news around the country whenever the state of Texas puts somebody to death. So, does it deter violent murders? Well, we have them every day here in the state of Texas and all over the world. So, I think the answer to that question is no, it doesn't deter completely. Does it deter to some degree? I think that's a debate that probably philosophers and psychologists should get together and have sometime.
I'm glad you thought to mention the issue of debt repayment, that view of punishment, that it's a matter of repaying your debt to society. And with a big kind of question mark next to it, like, what does that actually mean? How do you calculate this 20-year prison sentence to be, you know, paying a debt in any kind of equitable fashion for different kinds of crimes? And it's funny you mentioned that in relation to prison sentences in particular, because as you were talking, I was thinking a bit about the French philosopher Michel Foucault, who did this his quasi-historical analysis of the evolution of different kinds of punishment. And it's easy for us to forget that there weren't always things like prisons, that prisons were invented at a certain point. You know, in the history of mankind, punishment has taken all kinds of different forms. Sometimes it's torture. Sometimes it's a public spectacle. And you can see this in Star Trek, like the Cardassians would do public spectacle kinds of punishment, right? Klingons would do torturous executions kind of punishment. Mm-hmm. And so you can find, again, I think this is kind of why I want to make my case that the aliens in Star Trek are actually like the humans of historical society here in the real world, that, you know, these different kinds of punishments you can find in our own history. And at a certain point, prisons became kind of an invention that we realized as technology improved to keep people secure, to guard them, to observe them in various ways, you know, technological or otherwise. You know, like we put prison guards in there with their radios. They've got video cameras inside the prisons. They've got watchtowers. All this sort of stuff that's invented around prisons is kind of self-propagating. Once we realize that there's, in the attempt to be more humane and not to do torture and not to do public spectacles, I think the initial theory of the prison was that it was supposed to be a more humane thing to do than all of those other ways of punishing people that we can see in our own history. And then it looks like at the end of the day, you can ask the question, well, have we succeeded in creating a more humane experience by not doing those things and by putting people in prison cells for 20 years or 30 years or life? That's kind of a separate issue from the death penalty issue, because if it's a death penalty, then it's not like a life prison sentence or a very long prison sentence necessarily. But it's just easy to forget that the prisons didn't always exist. They were supposed to be solutions to these other problems in society. But fast forward the clock a little bit. What does the future evolutions of prisons look like? Is it just better technology, more secure brigs? You know, the kind of the more secure brig that Spock helped design on the Enterprise A in Star Trek V that he refers to. Right? There was a Vulcan that helped test the prison. He did have pointy ears, right? Yes. You know, is that the evolution of prisons? Do we just get better and better and better technology? Or at a certain point, do we radically reconceive of what punishment means? And I think you can see both examples in Star Trek. You do see better prisons and better brigs. Maybe you don't need prisons per se, but you have penal colonies. They're prison-like. You know, you still don't have much freedom. And then you do see these more enlightened approaches to punishment. I think maybe decriminalizing some things that don't aren't obviously criminal. I think there's lots of controversy here in the real world about whether things like drug offenses should be treated as a crime or should be treated psychologically, you know, through rehabilitation and whatnot. So, you know, I guess I just want to kind of see what would a future Foucault look back and say about the history of the punishment, you know, for the next 200 or 300 years, given that we're on this trajectory from torture to public spectacle to prisons, which are supposed to be more humane, which have their own set of really negative consequences that we've talked about a little bit. What is the future evolution of prisons for humanity, given that trajectory?
I think for the most part, the idea of the prison is to separate the criminal from society. Let's call it what it is. You know, again, I think sometimes we conflate these ideas because, you know, we talk about, well, they're in there repaying their debt to society.
Yeah, whatever that means.
And right? whatever that means. And yes, I realize, and some of our listeners will say, but, you know, I watch Orange is the New Black, and I know that they do stuff in there that's not just sitting in a 10x10 cell. I remember back when I was a kid, they talked about, you know, all the license plates were made in prison. That's where they make license plates. I know they do things in there. Again, I've been on the inside, but I really don't I really don't see oftentimes, especially in a maximum security situation where someone's doing 25 to life, they're repaying their debt to society. There's no debt being paid. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes for most of these people, there's no redemption. And then you have another side of this, Zachary, and it's actually something that we do see in the Star Trek universe, and that is the idea of asylums. And so when we talk about removing criminals from society, oftentimes what ends up happening, we take people who have criminal-like behavior, who do need rehabilitation, be it a pharmaceutical solution or, you know, a counseling solution, whatever that solution looks like. You've got someone like Garth of Izar, whom gods destroy from the original series. We put him in an asylum, and that asylum looks to me, Zachary, like a prison. Fast forward to, or actually we're going to go backwards because we did go back in time, but, you know, take Deep Space Nine, you know, when Captain Sisko goes back to the time of the Bell Riots in history, as it were to him, we have entire sections of cities that are kind of cordoned off, and they become asylums, if you will, for the degenerate of society. This is where we kind of herd them off to, and we put them behind these walls, and we don't look at them. And if we don't see them, then the problem doesn't exist. And I think, Zachary, that is what the prison system has become today. It's become a means of taking undesirable people or people whom society has determined as undesirable, and we put them away, we lock them away, we don't see them, there's no problem.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that's gotten worse in the last 20 years since that episode aired on Deep Space Nine. You know, that already was commentary on this increasing, criminalization of society. There are segments of society or types of crimes that are criminalized, resulting in this massive prison population boom, right? And mm-hmm. the effect of that over the last 20 years or so has been that there's a culture of sort of a prison culture. You know, there are whole mm-hmm. segments of the population that know, you know, what it means to kind of I'm speaking a little bit out of ignorance because, you know, this is not my experience, but there are segments of the population that live in this, like in the criminal justice system. You know, they're in, they're out, they're in, they're out, and every mm-hmm. Other people they know are in and out of prison, and that is life. To the point,
and oftentimes, Zachary, that starts at a very young age.
Oh, and it's not even. And again, this is what's so troubling about it. It's not even that it's always their fault, because all the role models, all the experience, all the people around them have created this culture. Intentionally or unintentionally, that people grow up in, and you know they end up stuck inside that system. And once you're in, you can't get out, right? I mean, you can't get a job, you can't function. It's very difficult to become a sort of functioning member of society, you know, as a whole, having had that experience and that background. So it is kind of this self-propagating, self-destructive element, and I think that episode of Deep Space Nine is really foretelling of that situation. You know, it's kind of predicting, like, hey, if this goes on and on and on, we will need to. There'll be so many people in prisons, we will need to just segment off an entire portion of a city to put these people in, and that's going to be the only way we can house these people. And you can see the seeds of that problem brewing in the attempt to constantly build more prisons and have to manage them. And what do you do with these people? They can't get jobs after they get done with prison, so they commit more crimes. So they go right back to prison, and we're right at smack in the middle of that becoming an increasing problem. So I guess the question is, you know, when in society do you put the brakes on that and you go, nope, we're going to try to find a totally different way to do this punishment experience, rather than just continuing to build more prisons to the point where we need to segment off a section of San Francisco and put all the prisoners there.
And again, this is one of the things that I love about being a Star Trek fan, because again, in the Star Trek universe, we look at these problems, we examine and we explore the human condition, including the ethics of punishment and crime and punishment. Again, as a fan, this is the reason I'm a Star Trek fan, because we don't ignore these things. We don't put them, you know, behind four walls and ignore it. We actually bring these things out and we talk about them and we explore them. And the thing that I find fascinating at the end of the day, even in an enlightened future, crime still exists, and it kind of brings me back to my own philosophical ideas. I do believe that evil is exists and it is loose in the world, and there is evil in the world, and I don't think any measure of enlightenment is going to purge that. So this is a problem that's going to require us to continue to evaluate as we move forward into that enlightened future and come up with better ways of addressing crime with punishments that do allow the repayment of debt to society, that do allow for redemption, that does maximize social utility, that is deserved, that does deter. I'm not saying I know what that looks like, but I think Star Trek gives us a really great platform to look at that and discuss it, and not just in terms of the Federation, but there are all sorts of and forms of punishment throughout the Star Trek universe. For instance, Deep Space Nine episode Paradise, Alexis used something called the box. I don't know if you remember the box, Zachary, that silver box, cramped quarters. If somebody broke the rules, the agreed upon rules of the society, they were ushered off and placed in this box. It was cramped quarters, very little airflow, and they would spend, you know, a day or days in there without food and water. When they come out, they were physically exhausted, dehydrated. I think most notably, Captain Sisko was placed in the box because he refused to remove his Starfleet uniform and integrate himself into their society. And so he was taken to the box. He was released. He was offered water if he would just simply change clothes. And he got up and he walked back to the box, proving once again that Sisko is a stud.
So in an episode like that, Mike, you know, it's a really interesting sort of creative take on a punishment experience, right? It's a different variation on a theme maybe, but
what kind of a public spectacle, yeah, I think, to some degree.
Absolutely. But what is kind of the moral takeaway? I mean, insofar as Star Trek has moral takeaways, you know, these are morality plays, right? So what do you think is the takeaway from the perspective of punishment or crime and punishment in that episode?
I think, Zachary, the big takeaway of that episode wasn't necessarily the spectacle, the public spectacle of the box or the severity of the punishment. I think at the end of the day, the idea is, or was rather, that you cannot forcibly manipulate a society to bend to the will and desire of a single person. That probably was the big takeaway of the box. But again, in our own society, we see different examples of those types of public spectacles being used. Klingons, for instance, we most associate Klingons with death and the death penalty. But, you know, they gave us Ruapente that we saw in Star Trek VI, and also in the Enterprise episode Judgment. It was a very famous dilithium mine, and strangely enough, two Starfleet captains are the only people to ever escape there. So I guess it's unescapable unless you are a Starfleet captain.
I actually think of the episode of Deep Space Nine where Worf is accused of this massacre of 400 people aboard a ship that decloaked in the middle of a battle. And it's not a trial, it's a hearing, but the Klingon prosecutor, for lack of a better word, accuser, or advocate, I think as he's called in the episode, comments that, you know, it's a strange system of justice where you have to prove your guilt versus proving innocence. And, you know, and it's interesting because in a lot of these other examples that we see in Star Trek, I think the running assumption is, you know, yeah, you know, if we have some evidence, then we assume you're guilty and you have to prove that you're innocent. And it's one thing that was distinctive, especially in our own history, in our own country, you know, the assumption of innocence and the need to prove guilt and having that written into our laws, that was distinctive at the time that America was formed. You know, that there, this was in reaction to this more top-down totalitarian, you know, torture slash spectacle slash having to prove your innocence kind of approach to justice. And it's funny that they take that core distinction between proving innocence versus proving guilt and put that again in a mock trial inside future society in Star Trek with Klingons of all things, right? To try to distance it from the real world as much as possible in true Star Trek tradition by putting it in the future and putting it with aliens with funny faces on, then you can really get to the heart of those issues and separate it from all the distractions of that we get in the real world that keep you from focusing on the moral issue at play. I just love that episode. For Klingons, the running assumption is that you have to prove your innocence. You don't prove guilt. That's not the burden of proof, and that's just counter to our own society. And it's interesting to see how that plays out inside the Star Trek universe.
Yeah, that's great that you mentioned that particular episode, because in addition to the Federation, probably the Klingons are the most fleshed out judicial system that we get to see. And really, to some degree, we fleshed out the Klingon judicial system more than the Federation. Mm-hmm. I think we go on the assumption that the Federation's judicial system is very much like our own. The Klingons, however, to some degree, is very different. And so we get to see that fleshed out a little bit. But it's fascinating to me that, you know, Ruapehte isn't the only thing that you have to fear through the Klingon judicial system. For instance, Worf received discommendation. That's where, very similar to what the Ferengi do, where the FCA seizes your wealth and your ability to make a profit in the Ferengi Alliance, the Klingons will discommodate you, and they will seize your ships and your land and so on. You lose your position in society.
Seven generations, right? The notion of hereditary punishment is really, yes. It's a real true Klingon notion, but it runs so far afront to human morality and American morality for sure, but, you know, probably most of human morality in general, probably. You know, it never really sort of sinks in how horrible of an idea that really is. I think when I watch the episodes where Worf gets his discommendation, I don't read it quite as horribly as that really sounds. Imagine being held accountable for something your great 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 grandfather did. I mean, that says volumes about the Klingon judicial system.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And then, of course, we have the Cardassian judicial system, where the verdict is known before the trial, and you're almost certain that the penalty will be death.
Yeah, and that's definitely, I was talking about a show trial. I mean, in Star Trek VI, and, you know, when Kirk and McCoy are accused of assassinating the Chancellor, you know, I think... I forget who comments that it's a damn show trial. Someone says it's a damn show trial, right? And yes. But Cardassians really have show trials, right? If you already know what the verdict's going to be, it's a performance, a public performance that you put on television and broadcast to society at large. I mean, talk about a show trial.
And we know from Chain of Command, Zachary, that Cardassians famously use torture as a means of punishment, as do the Romulans. We also see in the Star Trek universe something very interesting I want to mention, and that is the instrument of obedience. Instruments of obedience as preemptive, to some degree, forms of punishment. We see those in the Star Trek universe and on The Next Generation, where you're fit with said instrument. And if your attitude or your actions are not to the satisfaction of the person with the button, you get pain inflicted upon you. We also had in the mirror universe of Enterprise something called the Booth that we placed people in as a form of torture. Phlox was very capable in using the Booth to get what he wanted out of prisoners.
So I'm trying to kind of flesh out a taxonomy in my mind of different kinds of punishment in Star Trek. It seems like we have punishment as torture, right? Then you've mm-hmm. mentioned a few examples of that. We have punishment as a public spectacle. We have some variation on the prison experience, right? Different variations on whether it's a brig or a penal colony or the box, as you mentioned, right? Something that is analogous to a prison. And then there's these alternative forms of punishment, what I would call future punishment, right? These technological advances that try to deal with punishment in a different way. Am I missing anything in sort of the core taxonomy of different kinds of punishment in Star Trek? Those are the four that come to my mind.
Well, you can go Q and, you know, you have to fear being turned into a Belzoidian flea or...
With Q, everything's a public spectacle.
Neprelium amoeba. So we can go all Q and turn you into a bug or something like that. We can go Q. We already mentioned the quickening from Deep Space Nine. That's using using some type of bioweapon as a form of punishment to a society for resistance against the Dominion. Another form of a penal colony that we see in the Star Trek universe, we see in the Deep Space Nine episode Battle. A lot of Deep Space Nine here, Zachary. Battle Lines is the name of the episode. That is, if you remember, the Gamma Quadrant moon, where the Ennis and non-Ennis factions were taken, and they fought to the death, and then they fought to the death, and then they fought to the death, and then they fought to the death. So there are worse things than death, Metatrex listeners.
But have I missed anything, Mike, in terms of the core sort of types of punishment? And is the Star Trek bring anything really? I think everything in the category of future punishment is kind of uniquely Star Trek. But is there anything that doesn't fit neatly into the category of future punishment that is different than what you would see in other kinds of fiction or other kinds of science fiction?
I don't believe so. I really don't believe so.
And I guess the thing that I mean, a few minutes ago, you were talking about sort of society's attitude towards the prison experience. And I guess one of the things that concerns me so much about society is just the general lack of compassion towards people who cannot function like the rest of society. Mm-hmm. You know, in my mind, those are people, almost whatever they've done, those are people who are really broken in some way. It might be their fault. It might not be their fault. They might be able to get better. They might not be able to get better. But in my mind, there's always this kind of core compassion that should be there. And Star Trek is unique in this regard. I think whenever Star Trek deals with punishment in this future sense, especially in the enlightened version of Star Trek future in the 24th century, right? The Next Generation / Deep Space Nine / Voyager approach to punishment. I think there's kind of this core compassion. I kind of envision Captain Picard. I'm thinking of the episode The Wounded from Star Trek The Next Generation. That's the episode when Captain Maxwell, Captain O'Brien, or Chief O'Brien's former captain, has basically commandeered his own ship and has gone about starting to destroy Cardassian ships, thinking that the Cardassians are rearming. And at the end of that episode, Captain Picard tells Gul Masset, the Cardassian captain, that if Captain Maxwell can't function in a time of peace, which is code for saying he can't function like the rest of us, he can't find a place mm-hmm. for himself, we can pity him, but we're not going to dismiss him. And I think I can picture Picard saying that about the prison experience or the punishment experience in general. If people can't function with the rest of society, we should pity them. They deserve our pity and our compassion, but we're not going to throw them away. And that strikes me as kind of the heart of of you know, a more enlightened approach to punishment. You know, it's not that we, you know, lock people in a room and forget about them. It's not that we, you know, torture them. It's not that we put them on spectacle. We really try our best to be compassionate and to help them where we can, but we don't throw them away. That's not what an enlightened people do. I can just picture Picard. Can't you picture Picard giving this really impassioned speech about the nature of punishment? It seems like something totally in line with what you see in terms of values in the 24th century and Picard's personality.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head right there. And I think that does need to be at the heart and soul of our real world, real universe discussion in regards to crime and punishment. I think compassion needs to be the key. We can't afford, you know, we can't afford to dismiss people. Even if they are willful offenders, we really can't afford to dismiss them. And
that's the thing that's so troubling. I think in the real world, people are so discompassionate about mm-hmm. that situation. We get, I don't want to say we get judgmental. It's just such a loosey-goosey word. But we tend to moralize to the point where we demonize the individuals and we forget that they're really broken people. And it just strikes me that in the 24th century, like Gene Roddenberry would have thought, that we would move beyond that kind of heavy moralization and up the compassion factor and downplay the demonization factor.
I think to some degree that very debate was at the heart and soul of the Voyager episode Meld from season 2 episode 16. That of course is the episode in which crewman Suter commits a murder, and when he is discovered he comes clean about the murder, and Tuvok melds with him. And the result of that meld was negative for Tuvok, so he loses control of his emotions. And during that period in which he's lost control, he has it's a pretty significant disagreement with Captain Janeway. And one of the few times that you really see Tuvok and Janeway butting heads on anything, you know, Janeway's solution is, we can't put him in the brig for the rest of the journey, so we're going to confine him to quarters. And I think I may be reading into this or maybe retconning it a little bit to some degree, but I think in Janeway's mind, she was tabling the issue until she could come up with a better solution.
Until she gets the ship home.
Until she gets, hopefully we can get the ship home.
Someone else's problem, they get home, right?
And make it someone else, yes, yes. But, you know, I want to retcon that a little bit and say that, you know, Janeway simply wanted to come up with another solution, to find a way in order for Suter to pay his debt, so to speak, to the ship. And Tuvok, of course, you know, disagreed. And during that time of not having control of his emotions, he said to Janeway, her unwillingness to put him to death was a sign of her own weakness. And he obviously felt that that was the best solution. However, over the course of the series, Tuvok obviously changes his tune to some degree, and I think it was more Zachary than him regaining his control over his emotions. He was actually instrumental in rehabilitating to some degree crewman Suter. So I think that debate is at the heart of that episode.
You know, I'm glad that you mentioned Tuvok and maybe by extension Vulcans in general, because Vulcans have a different situation than humans because they have the ability to keep in check their basic emotional reaction to these kinds of situations. And we ordinary, you know, non-Vulcan humans don't have that luxury. You know, we're inherently emotional beings. I think you can ask this really interesting question about what the relationship is of emotions to the issue of punishment. You know, to what extent is our sort of disgust by certain kinds of crimes, should that inform, you know, what kinds of punishments are deserved in that situation? Or is that emotional reaction really a human failing that's unrelated to what someone actually deserves and the best way to punish someone? And, you know, I for me personally, I think I mentioned this once before on Metatrex, but I've been on a jury for a murder trial. You know, I you know, set a guilty verdict and I sent someone to prison for 30 years to life. You know, and that is a massive amount of responsibility. And it's funny to look back on it, though, and think about the different emotions that I felt in the course of the trial and in the course of deliberations. And as I look back on it, you know, years after the fact now, You know, I experienced a full gamut of human emotions in relation to this situation. You know, compassion for the victim. You know, anger at the defendant. I experienced compassion for the defendant, right? You know, just knowing that he was a dysfunctional human being that couldn't function with the rest of society. You know, and I experienced a full range of emotions about that. And I asked myself, what's the relationship between that and punishment? I think it's very easy to get over emotionally stimulated by the idea of punishing someone and that being what's right, and sort of committing someone to have bad consequences to them because they did something bad. And I think there's a part of us that maybe is our baser, more emotional, the part that Tuvok and Spock would really criticize, right? That there's this gut reaction. We rejoice a little bit in seeing other people suffer for things they've done. And that is this gut emotional reaction that, on the one hand, I think that moral disgust is good because it can help steer you in terms of what's right and wrong. If it's in tune, then you go, okay, this is great and this is on track and this is morally disgusting. And so you don't do those things. I think we do have this inner moral sentiment. In fact, there's a whole theory of ethics about that called sentimentalism that tries to ground our moral and ethical judgments in our innermost sentiments. But, you know, it's really when that gets out of balance in some way, I think we can either desensitize ourselves to certain kinds of situations, or at worst, we can celebrate in other people's suffering in the name of punishment, in the name of justice. And I just don't think it's clear at all what the relationship is between emotions and what kinds of punishments are justified for certain kinds of crimes based on those sentiments. And, you know, I'm not above saying, you know, I felt some of those baser emotions in the course of that experience. I'm not even proud of that. I think it's just a fact of human nature that we have this reaction. We do delight in seeing other people suffer a little bit, and that is part of the reason we punish them, and we feel good about punishing people who go to prison. And I would say that's probably gotten out of balance in society, to where we over celebrate that and we forget the compassionate element and realize that people who commit crimes are, you know, 99 times out of 100 are broken for one reason or another. And I just hope that in the future we figure that out. I certainly don't think we figured it out now, and you know, maybe in the 23rd century they haven't figured it out either, if they're giving the death penalty for going to Talos IV. But in the 24th century, it seems like Picard's got it all figured out, and he would say at very least we would pity them, that most we would give them compassion, but we're not going to throw people away and we're not going to rejoice in seeing them suffer. I hope we at least get to that point in society.
It occurs to me, Zachary, you make a very good point here, and I think in reality the modern judicial system to a great degree has become theater. Now, I don't want to come across as sounding as though I've lost faith in the judicial system or the judicial process. I still believe at the core it is a process intended to get to the truth, as they say. However, we have injected a lot of theater into it. And so I think the goal, I think for most attorneys, whether they be, you know, a prosecutor or a defense attorney, is to, you know, cause the jury and those who are witness to the trial to get them to, you know, evoke a certain emotion. I think one would come to the conclusion that, you know, perhaps the perfect solution to that is something that looks a little bit more like maybe a Vulcan, with my irony quotes there, a Vulcan jury trial where it's all logic and the rule of law. However, you know, there's a danger there as well. And I think of the Next Generation episode Justice, in which Wesley disturbed new plants in something called a punishment zone. on the Edo homeworld, it resulted in the death penalty. Now, I think it's important to note that the punishment zone was randomly designated every day, and it was kept a secret. And they were very disconnected to, you know, the punishment that obviously didn't fit the crime. He disturbed some plants, and so now he's violated the punishment zone. He's going to be put to death. And I think there's a danger of going the other way too. So I think the emotions, the emotionalism, if you will, can be a double-edged sword. I think certainly we should be disgusted when for instance, innocence are violated in our society. I remember a few years ago, my wife's grandfather, who is a 90-year-old World War II combat veteran, served in the South Pacific in the Navy during World War II. You know, he was a witness to Iwo Jima. I mean, it just, you know, I think about this guy and I think about his extraordinary life and what a good person he is and a good citizen.
There aren't too many
of
those guys left.
Not too many of those guys left. And you know, I know what it is to feel emotion when we got the call that, you know, some thugs had broken into his house and had beaten him severely, all to probably steal prescription medications from his home.
My goodness.
You know, I was angry. I was very upset. And, you know, I certainly experienced some of those baser emotions. And I think we should be angry over those things. However, I certainly don't think those thugs, whoever they are, should be put to death. What is an appropriate punishment for something like that? I think that's a debate for, you know, someone else on another program. But I think we should feel those emotions to some degree, but we can't allow those emotions to overwhelm us to the point that we lose perspective. You know, what are the limits to punishment? You know, we have to look at the punishment, what the limits to that punishment are, and what that punishment is designed to do. And I think they do that to some degree in the Federation, in our enlightened Federation. Again, you know, crime doesn't go away, but the punishments seem to be more enlightened, although we see other cultures, other societies within the Star Trek universe use very cruel and unusual means of punishment. You know, that we talked about again, the devices that they use to demand and command loyalty and obedience, the box, these, you know, prison systems, these dilithium mines, the Breen use them, the Cardassians use them, the Klingons use them. You know, do we take someone who beats up an old, you know, Starfleet veteran, do we take them and put them on Rua Pente? Does that fit the crime? Or
we'd at least give them a Vulcan jury.
Or do we send them to New Zealand, or do we enact punishment protocol number 9? I'm
glad you thought to mention this idea of a Vulcan jury, frankly, because I think this speaks to the heart of the human condition in terms of crime and punishment and how you decide whether someone's guilty and then of course what their punishment should be. I think this is the reason that in a real trial, when you're on a jury, the judge will take great pains to explain to you that you're supposed to use reason and not your emotions. You're supposed to look at the evidence and take whatever emotions you've got and set them aside for the purpose of focusing on the facts and
yet those two attorneys will do everything in their power to make you feel those emotions.
Oh, absolutely. And then you can ask the question, I think, and this is what sort of the power and the failing of our real life legal system. And then of course it's always here on Metatrex, we always want to ask ourselves, what does this mean for Star Trek and for us in the future? Mm-hmm. But here in the real world, it seems like, you know, if it were up to one individual, just the judge, to make a decision, then the judge could be swayed by emotions too easily, right? That theater can have an effect on one person in a very catastrophic kind of way. But when you put 12 people together inside of a jury room, it's amazing how at best the sort of core rationality of mankind can kind of rise to the surface in talking things out, in debating. The truth kind of does get laid bare and people can counter each other. And I would say probably most of the time, you know, a good verdict is reached and a good rational verdict. At worst, you know, this is the failing of that kind of system. At worst, it can be sort of tyranny of the masses, where 12 people can band together and convince each other and go off in left field and get each other on some emotional roller coaster and, you know, and lose their rationality. And I think that's how a Vulcan would probably view the legal system. And I love in that episode that we mentioned about Deep Space Nine, the one when Worf is being accused by the Klingon prosecutor in this hearing to determine whether he's committed a massacre and should be extradited to the Klingon Empire. I love that the judge or the admiral playing the role of the judge in that hearing is a Vulcan. I think that's totally symbolic of the justice system in the 24th century that should be based on sort of pure reason and, you know, the emotional theater going on in the course of this hearing shouldn't have an effect on the logical Vulcan admiral or judge in that case. So I kind of imagine 12 Vulcans but I guess this is an interesting question. I think is this like the best case for justice? You know, if we take pure rationality and put 12 purely rational people and put them in a room together, or is there something important? Does emotion play some sort of really important moral sentiment kind of role, either in terms of whether whether a person is guilty or not, or whether which kinds of crimes are more severe than others, or what kind of punishments are appropriate for what kinds of crimes? How much of that is purely rational, and how much do we really justifiably rely on our emotion to sort out the gradations in those and find distinctions among those kinds of situations and types of crimes and types of punishment? I think we rely on emotions an awful lot, and it seems like justifiably so. I think, you know, certain kinds of crimes stir our emotions worse than others, and those that tends to be the more serious, egregious, you know, more despicable crimes that we that inner sentiment tells us that's really, really, really wrong, and yes. It's not just jaywalking, right? It's something worse than mm-hmm. that. And it seems like if you don't have some sort of emotional core to rely on, you do end up with something like that episode Justice from The Next Generation, where you just have a bunch of rules and a bunch of arbitrary punishments, and they don't match up because you don't have any moral sentiment to tell you, you know, which punishments are worse than others and for what reasons. And you can imagine a justice system run amok if it were based on that kind of situation too. So I'm not sure that the 24th century vision of a Vulcan sitting in the judge's seat or 12 Vulcans on a jury is really the best approach to justice. I think we do rely on our emotions to make those distinctions. The danger is in relying solely on the emotion and not checking it with your reason. And all this sounds a little obvious. I'm not saying anything people don't already know probably, but it's interesting to kind of fast forward into the future and think, you know, as we add compassion, maybe this is my final thoughts as we've been here talking for a little over an hour now. I think as we move further into the future, I would like to see us up the compassion factor and actually find a real way to solve these problems in society and help the people who can't function normally in society and stop demonizing them and stop relying solely on emotion and enjoying seeing them suffer because of things they've done. It just strikes me, it just seems a little obvious to me that that's kind of the baser part of human nature. And if those of us who are futurists and progressivists and want to move towards the future that we see, the more enlightened future that Star Trek gives us a glimpse of, that seems like the right direction. Building a better prison and using the technology. A few episodes ago on Metatrex, we had a discussion about technology and the industrial design philosophy of Star Trek. You know, there's an industrial design philosophy of prisons in Star Trek, Briggs, and all the technology surrounding keeping people isolated from society. You know, if you focus just on that to the exclusion of all those other factors, it just seems like the problem's only going to get worse and worse and worse and worse. And of course, I don't have the answer, but it just seems like Gene Roddenberry, I think, would be really disappointed. I keep invoking Gene Roddenberry here. Gene Roddenberry would be disappointed that. But I really think so. I think Gene Roddenberry would be disappointed at this lack of progressiveness in terms of how to deal with punishment, because it's a problem that seems to be getting worse in society and not better, and it might take a really creative solution, a future punishment solution, a Star Trek punishment solution to really solve the issue. But I'm not sure it needs to be as extreme as simulating 20 years in prison and in with false memories or anything like that. But I think upping the compassion factor. I picture the Picard speech as maybe my final thought on the punishment issue. What would Picard say about punishment? Well, you know, we can pity them, we can have compassion, but we're not going to throw them away. And if that's the best we can do, that's still probably better than we're doing now.
Yeah, and an excellent sentiment it is, Zachary. And I you know, I think for my final thoughts, nothing apart from what I've already said, other than I think one of the best examples of the punishment fitting the crime actually comes to us from the Next Generation episode The First Duty. That, of course, is the episode in which Wesley Crusher, along with Cito Jaxa, and, of course, Nick Locarno and one other Academy cadet were involved in an illegal maneuver during a flight demonstration that led to the death of one of their fellow cadets. And so, you know, there's a trial, a hearing, if you will, and an investigation. And of course, in the course of that episode, Nick Locarno finally, after a little bit of pressure from Wesley, comes clean about his part in all of that. He resigns from the Academy. The other cadets, however, were allowed to return to the Academy. All of the work that they had done for that year had been been basically expunged away, and so they had to basically start over and do that year again. And Cito Jaxa actually says to Captain Picard later on, when she was assigned to the Enterprise, that that was a very difficult time for her. And it occurs to me, Zachary, that even though their negligence led to the death of a fellow cadet, there was a measure of compassion given to them, an opportunity for them to redeem themselves. And I think in the case of at least Wesley Crusher and Cito Jaxa, I think they did. And I think that Picard is absolutely right, and I see that applied in this particular episode.
I think that's exactly the kind of thing I'm describing in terms of Picard's reaction to punishment. Picard went out of his way to make sure she got on his ship so he could make sure that she had a fair chance to redeem herself. And that was proactive on Captain Picard's part. He could have scoffed at her. He could have refused her posting on the Enterprise. He could have had her expelled from the Academy. Without a doubt, Picard could have thrown his hat into the mix and caused something worse to happen for all the people involved in that scenario back at the Academy. But that's not what Picard did. Picard went out of his way to make sure that Cito Jaxa got a fair chance to redeem herself and function again and be a contributing part of Starfleet. And that kind of compassionate and proactive attempt to help someone become a better person just strikes me as that's exactly the kind of reaction that I think Picard would have towards punishment in general.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more. Well, Zachary, it's been fun talking about the ethics of punishment on Star Trek, but this isn't the only thing that we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week, so here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
You don't create a better future, and then it's just there, and it's just stagnant, and nothing ever threatens it. Right, that's not reality.
Yeah, you'd end up with Star Trek The Next Generation if you did that, right?
Right, well, exactly. And I think that's why a lot of people who love The Next Generation don't like Deep Space Nine, because Deep Space Nine challenges that premise.
The Orb.
Maybe later, maybe he could have come back in like season 7 and he was in love with Kira, Odo was in love with Kira, and they could have had an Ombojutsu match to see who would win her heart.
Women at Warp.
Admiral Alan Alda came to visit Captain Coretta Scott King. Meanwhile, morale officer Beyonce is trying to deal with her new Weasley sweater. And
they're all partying at the First Contact party.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us tremendously, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the shows as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, it's okay. We've got you covered as well. You can find all our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can always stream and download the MP3 file from our website, and you can grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks that we have for you. These perks include early access to content through our Patron Zone, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and many, many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us. We hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we've discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can look in the sidebar on our show page on the Trek FM website, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
You can also find us on Twitter. Our handle is at TrekFM.
On Facebook, you can find us at facebook.com/TrekFM. And find us in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. Just type Babel into the search field on Facebook. That's B-A-B-E-L, and it'll come right up. Or you can go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
And Zachary, I want to encourage our listeners to get in on this conversation. What forms of punishment are you aware of in the Star Trek universe? And do you feel that they're effective in remedying the crime for which they've been levied? So help us continue that discussion. Jump in on our show thread when the show posts, and let's continue this conversation. We'd also like to invite you to leave us a rating and a review of MetaTreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. We might even read your review right here on the podcast. Well, Zachary, when you're not serving your sentence under Punishment Protocol Number 9, where can our listeners find you around the network and on the interwebs?
You will exercise Punishment Protocol 9 Alpha.
Well, you can find me in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group, if you want to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can also find me on Twitter. My handle there is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And Mike, when you're not spending 30 days in Captain Janeway's brig, where can people find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, you can find me, of course, on Facebook. That's where I'm most active, and around the Babel Conference. Also on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, cmichael1701. Zachary, we'd also like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from the network. These are fine people who put in lots of time off mic in order to bring MetaTreks to our listeners each week. Specifically, we'd like to thank, again, C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek FM, our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Norman Lau, our art director, Aaron Harvey, content manager, Will Wynn, our production manager who works every single day doing something, making sure that these podcasts get out, that's Richard Marquez, and our editor and producer, Dennis Castello. We'd also like to give a shout out to our associate producer, Patrick Devlin. Patrick, thank you so much for your support of Trek FM and of MetaTreks. You can reach out and contact Patrick on Twitter. His handle is at MagicDrop5. Well, thanks everyone for listening to MetaTreks, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.